Our use of mourning has broken as a song to commemorate the birth of the Christian religion and the birth of this particular church makes me think of something else. We have a little more music than usual on this Easter Sunday, a change I not only welcome, but which I think is entirely right for the mood of the morning. My personal feeling is that on Easter especially, we should have even more music and fewer words. Words are the right medium for an appeal to logic and reason. Music is the right medium for an appeal to feeling and emotion. It isn't that they never cross those lines, but as a general rule, language addresses itself to the mind. Music addresses itself to the heart. Professors of literature and language love to tell you that the preeminent human gift is language. Professors of musical theory and performance love to tell you that it is music. It's a debate that is not likely to be settled. So what, you ask, does all this have to do with Easter? Well, what I'm trying to say is that I'm glad we have special music on this particular Sunday, because for most worshipers, it's a day for feeling more than for thought, for mood more than for logic. The Christian world is united in celebrating the emotions of joy and hope on this day, but it has profound differences about the intellectual basis for that joy and hope. Let's put it in the simplest possible terms. Millions of Christians believe that the dead body of Jesus of Nazareth came back to genuine physical life, threw off the grave wrappings, and walked out of the tomb with renewed heartbeat, kidney function, hunger, and thirst, including the painful memory of his recent dreadful suffering. But millions of other Christians, including devoted ministers and dedicated scholars, believe that the resurrection story is more symbolic than it is literal. That it is meant to celebrate the ongoing power of the Spirit of Christ, which has given life to churches and to individuals for 20 centuries. Ask these people what the story was meant to teach us, and they will explain it as I might in words like these. My beloved father died many years ago, but as a profound influence, he still lives. Not as a physical presence, with the intense blue eyes and the strong jawline, but as a living presence in my mind and heart. I can't feel his hand on my shoulder as I once did, or his arms around me on a return visit home, but his influence, purged of the impediments of space and time, is greater in some ways than it ever was. I mean to say that the very essence of that man lives in me. This may not be enough for some who sit here this morning, and if this is true, please believe that I deeply respect the convictions you brought on this day and that motivate you, I assume, on every day of the year. I ask you to believe me when I say that I have no wish to change the very literal nature of your Easter faith. But I do think it is important to remind you that the Christian world is divided on the meaning of the resurrection story, and that we should make every possible effort to understand and appreciate one another. When we hear deeply devoted and highly intelligent ministers say, as I heard some say last week, that, quote, most of those who worship in my denomination do not believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus, end of quote, we owe it to ourselves to ask why. And these are some of the things they would say to us. If God is a spirit, they ask, and if flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven, what possible difference can it make what happened to the physical body of Jesus? And if it truly was a physical body that walked out of the tomb, what happened to it when Jesus, according to another story, ascended into heaven? A physical body cannot do that. So did the physical Jesus first die, then live again
in the flesh,
only to be transformed one more time
in order to make
the ascension story possible? Let me rephrase it
and ask you to think about it
one more time. If one reads the resurrection story
in a literal way,
that a physical body was reanimated, what kind of body does Luke have in mind
when he says that a little later,
while the disciples were watching,
he was lifted up
and a cloud took him out of their sight? What kind of body would that have been?
These are not
easy questions.
Is it wrong
somehow to ask such things
and to confess to some confusion about how to read
the stories? Surely not, it seems to me,
when we find confusion
and ambiguities in the stories themselves.
Christ.
One moment we read that the disciples are in a room with the doors locked, and Jesus simply materializes on the inside. Something
we pretend the fictional characters on the
Starship Enterprise can do,
but which we know doesn't
happen to actual physical
bodies.
But then in the next moment,
we're told that
Thomas puts his fingers into the nail prints, the writer then insisting that we
imagine a corporeal,
physical body
just like ours.
What exactly
are we to believe?
If some of you
have studied the resurrection narrative
as long
and as carefully as you have studied medicine,
or law,
or biology,
or music, or business,
you know one thing
without my having to mention it.
And that is that the four
different Gospels differ remarkably
in how they
present the details of that story.
I used to finish
my Bible as Literature
classes at the university
by putting the four Gospels side
by side
in easily referenced parallel columns,
so students
could see that about the only thing they
agree on fully
is that their Lord and Master
still lives.
But they leave us
with ambiguity
about how he lives.
Was the life that arose
a physical self
or an unconfined spirit,
set free
of physical limitations
to dwell in the hearts of people
through all centuries to come?
You know, if the greatest and most devout minds
of 2,000 years
have not been able to settle those questions, we're not likely to. Which brings me
around
full circle to where I began,
by saying that I think we're better off
to celebrate this day with music. than with words.
Last year, we did that.
And Bob Scott assures me we will do it again next year. But in between, I have had to make a sermon of words when I'd rather simply listen to the brass, look at the flowers, feel the truth of resurrection in the budding trees and the springing grass. If any of you have ever wondered what I will enjoy most when I am no longer making sermons, the answer is very easy for me. Not having to intrude ever again into the pure emotions of an Easter Sunday audience. My plan will be to seek out churches on Easter
where music is heard
and nobody speaks.
But that indulgence is still some distance, I hope, in the future.
So why not, somebody asks,
just go ahead
and say the cliches and forget about the long history of problems and questions. Why not speak in exclamation marks like those ads do on Saturday
morning's paper?
The ads for Easter Sunday.
Why remind us
of things that trouble thought
when what many of us want is to rejoice without having to think?
Well, believe me,
that is exactly what I wish I could do. And it is an impossibility for me. I do not know how to stand in front of you and pretend that on the far side
of the bunnies and the bonnets,
the flowers and the trumpets,
there are no deep
and puzzling questions
about what Christians believe
who will be meeting in churches
all over the world
this day. Three recent books
have been written
to add to a tremendous amount of literature on the subject of the resurrection. And I read only a few days ago a review of all three of those books
written by a Jesuit priest, Father Richard Clifford, who says exactly
what I have just tried to say to you
in a little less academic language than he uses.
I'd like you to listen to him
very carefully.
The New Testament evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, which is the natural starting point
for any serious theological investigation,
offers
its own
peculiar problems.
The gospel traditions, this Jesuit priest says,
are impossible
to harmonize.
They are separate expressions
of the Eastern faith,
edited according to the special viewpoint of each evangelist.
Now listen even harder for one
last sentence.
Behind all these traditions, of course,
is the conviction
that Jesus of Nazareth lives, but his mode of living is differently conceived
in the four Gospels. Now, since I know my own
convictions best,
I think the greatest compliment I can pay you is to express them
honestly and openly and give you a chance
to agree
or to challenge.
They're not unique
or original.
In every generation,
people who honor Christ and try to follow
his way of life
have said such things as I am about
to say.
It seems quite
clear to me, for example,
that the Apostle Paul,
who wrote the earliest and most authentic
documents of Christianity,
did not
interpret
the resurrection of Jesus
in any other
than a spiritual sense. He makes no distinction
between the appearance
to himself of Jesus
on the road to Damascus
and the appearance to earlier disciples
like
James and John, Peter and Andrew. What is important to the great apostle
is that the Spirit
of Jesus, a man he almost certainly never met in the flesh,
lives in him
and transforms his life. It is absolutely vital to my conception of Christianity that the resurrection of Jesus take place in the human soul, which is what I think happened to those
who had loved
and then lost a physical
presence.
They became convinced that he was not
absent,
but with them always,
even to the end of the world,
that in him was a power
death could not destroy,
and that this power was now
theirs.
What Easter says
to us
when we are tempted
to live in the basement
is that his Spirit is
present in us,
and we are better
than that.
Most people
who believe
in a literal, physical resurrection
feel that no one can truly
be a Christian who does not
believe in the same way.
They may be right,
but if they are,
they rule out
of the Christian family
multitudes of splendid followers of Jesus
through all the ages
whose reading of that story
is not like
theirs. I'll use one example
to stand for
thousands of others.
Take the man who, in my opinion,
will be regarded as the 20th century's
most
genuine and complete
embodiment
of the life of Jesus,
Albert Schweitzer.
I have studied his life and thought with special care over the years,
and I simply cannot
imagine how anyone could imitate
the
sacrificial love of Christ
more completely
than this German Christian.
And yet this man,
with brilliant futures
in medicine,
music, philosophy, and theology, left the rich cultural life
of Europe
to go heal simple black people
in a hot,
humid African jungle
because
of his profound faith in the life
and teaching of Jesus.
He so honors
Jesus of Nazareth
that when he refers
to him
in print, he capitalizes the pronoun to show his respect and adoration.
But he did not
believe
in a bodily resurrection.
It was,
he would say to you,
the spiritual life
and power
of Jesus that was resurrected in the hearts
of his first followers,
and that same Spirit
is risen in
my own heart to send me to the banks
of the Ogawa River,
the divine Spirit
that once inhabited
a physical body in the first century
now inhabits
mine.
I hold
a similar faith,
and it is what I mean
when I say or sing,
he is risen.
I believe that
we are the body
in which our Lord is resurrected. And I think over and over again of the jubilant cry of the great Apostle Paul, "He lives in me." For Paul, as for me, that is the essence of the resurrection story. And I think if Paul had known that special little song we sang a little while ago, he might have used those very words to say after the darkness of his former life was illuminated by the radiant life of Jesus, "Morning has broken."